Yes, yes, of course, get out. But if you want to see a freaking fantastic film, get in. And I mean get thee to a theater as soon as you can. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Man, oh man, when I saw Get Out as the surprise screening at 2017 Sundance Film Festival, I gotta say I was truly blown away by it. Aside from the timeliness of the material, writer-director Jordan Peele has completed such a smart and tightly woven thriller that's filled with the imaginative tropes you crave from a horror film, but presented in a new and fresh way, and I can't say enough good things about this film, and I was determined as all hell to get it into the screening series and podcast, and luckily, I got to. This screening took place pre-release to a sold-out crowd, and there was spontaneous applause throughout the third act for this very satisfying ending, and it was just truly inspired writing and directing, which is all the more impressive again because it's Jordan Peele's feature film writing directing debut. Peele had a lot of great things to say about his process and what the film means to him, so I know you'll dig this episode. But first, I've got a question for you. Are you crazy enough to write your own screenplay? This episode is sponsored by the fine folks over at ScreenCraft.org. ScreenCraft specializes in screenwriting competitions by genre, tailoring the prize package and the Hollywood jury specifically to each genre contest. Stay tuned for the comedy contest opening this week at ScreenCraft and the horror contest opening in a couple months. ScreenCraft is dedicated to helping writers succeed by connecting talented screenwriters with top producers, managers, and agents. The annual ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship offers winners the opportunity to mentor with Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers, as well as studio executives, agents, and managers. So here's the deal. Enter any and all ScreenCraft writing competitions in 2017 with the exclusive discount code QAPODCAST. That's all one word, QAPODCAST, and you will save 10% off your entry. Check out ScreenCraft.org for more info, and don't forget to use your coupon code. And speaking of other cool things to dig online, I hope you'll also check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates, because soon enough it'll become the fully functional magazine. We're in the process of converting all of our old issues and figuring out how the new software we're using works, but soon enough you'll be able to see it this year at backstory.net. You will also be able to see it on Android tablets, I just found out today, so there's plenty of new places to see it, and I thank you for your patience. Now, issue 26, our Oscar issue just published, and if you have an iPad, I hope you'll check it out. Aside from being able to read the full screenplays of all the Oscar nominees, we interviewed the writers and had them present us with their favorite scenes and toughest scenes and comment on them. Plus, we show you the pages that they talk about within the article and the other lessons that they've learned from their stories, so I know you'll dig these articles from the Oscar-nominated screenwriters. You could also read the full Blacklist screenplay Burn Run, plus an interview with its writer, an in-depth piece about the graphic novel Mayday, a look into what it took for James Mangold to get Logan made, and a bunch of Sundance coverage and tons more. So I hope you check out issue 26, our Oscar issue. Right now you could see our beautiful painted cover image with plenty of characters from the Oscar-nominated films, all dancing on the freeway La La Land style, and you could also see our table of contents over at backstory.net as well. Of course, if you're so inclined, you could buy an issue or subscribe on your iPad, so thanks for considering. And one last reminder, while you are fiddling around online, if you have a script ready to enter into a competition, go to screencraft.org because they have some great ones coming up, and you could use your QA podcast code to save some cash. So of course, as my latest trend, I have a quick note about the sound, and I know it's been a lot lately. I just feel kind of like Han Solo repeatedly saying, it's not my fault, but this one is kind of strange. Since this was a pre-release screening, we had security there that night at the theater with night vision goggles to keep things kosher on the piracy front, and during the Q&A, security stuck around. And podcast spoiler alert, as we later found out, one of the security guards leaned up against the fire alarm and set it off. So, you will hear a fire alarm blast forth once or twice, and we had no idea what was going on or why it was happening, but I'm just letting you know now, so you have no dire concerns. There was no fire, all's well, and we gotta tell security next time to not stand over yonder by the alarm. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage at the lovely Los Angeles Film School as I introduce debut screenwriter-director Jordan Peele to talk about his film, Get Out.
Thank you. Man, y'all are some sick fucks. Laughing at that kind of obscene violence. You guys are crazy. It's humid in here. It got, I don't know if you guys know, it got dewy.
It is. Throw some water on those rocks. We'll have a nice sauna. So, you know, I just want to get this out of the way as we start. I, too, would have voted for Obama for a third term. But I'm not going to call you my man because that's possessive wrong.
That's possessive and wrong.
Jordan Peele, it's good to see you.
So I want to get this out of the way before we start. You look like Mark Wahlberg with a beard and hat and some glasses.
How do you know I'm not?
I don't know that.
All right.
For sure.
So, you know, we're sitting here at the lovely Los Angeles Film School. Were you trained? Did you go through theatrical training at any point in your life?
You know, as an actor, certainly, this, you know, filmmaking has always been a dream of mine. And no, I don't have any kind of formal training in that respect. But, you know, I was lucky enough to work on several shows, Mad TV, work on some movies. And then, of course, Key and Peele, you guys heard of it? And Key and Peele was kind of like, you know, it was like production boot camp, you know, obviously. It's like 300 short films. So, yeah, that put me through the ropes. And you never know if you're going to be ready, but, you know, I think it paid off.
We'll get to Key and Peele in a second, but, you know, because that kind of marks your writing, that and Mad TV, when you started writing. But just because you started as an actor, I love asking actors, what was your worst audition? The one that still traumatizes you to this very day.
You know, there's a lot. You know, the odd thing about auditioning is sometimes sometimes the worst audition you end up getting the role. You know, that happened with Wanderlust. That it was where it was awful, and I, you know, felt like I just totally blew it. But they were on my side.
We screened that here with David Wayne. We love David. Wayne.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Well, he's you know obviously a good friend at this point. But I thought I totally blew it. Nothing funny about this story, but I just,
you blew it.
I just remember coming in, and I remember it was Ken Marino who, I couldn't make him laugh. And he's like, yeah, good. Thank you. You know, when you get that, you get that, sort of, thanks for coming out. That's really nice of you to make the time in your schedule. It's like, well, fuck, this isn't about me. I'll give you the role. You know, David talked Ken into it, and Ken expressed later on at the rap party. You know, Ken came up to me, maybe a little tipsy. He was like, "Hey, you know, I didn't want to hire you. You proved me wrong, buddy. You proved me wrong." So yeah, that was it.
You were great in the film. So
thank you.
As you were moving forward as an actor, you were on Mad TV. You got to start writing, and television was a training ground for you. What were some of the things that you learned about screenwriting on the job?
You know, Mad TV was an interesting experience because I don't think that the show really matched my comedic sensibilities. You know, they were really into the recurring character, and I was kind of into this idea of sketches, like you walk the edge and you fucking push the boundaries, and that's what sketches is about. And so I would write myself these sketches that were maybe a little esoteric or tricky or, you know, some way out of the box, and they just wouldn't go. So I got a lot of experience writing, you know, shit that would never get made, basically. But also kind of figuring out how to take my voice and eventually make something that would work with the show and work with my voice by the end of that experience. So, you know, that's one of the things I learned is how to make these two, you know, things work, this square object and this round hole, and let's make a sketch that satisfies both these things.
As we get into Key and Peele, and that'll be my last thing before we get into Get Out.
Okay.
I'm a fan of the show, as many are as well, and you really had control over your own domain, and you were talking a second ago about esoteric writing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember a sketch where you guys were too scared to say the word bitch because you were scared your wives might hear you upstairs.
Oh, yeah. I said bitch. That's
the
flagship sketch of Key and Peele.
Right,
yeah.
So you're whispering it, but I mean, the first time I was watching it, just as a construction of writing, I really mean this, was I was like, okay, I wonder where they're going to go with this. Yeah. But by the end of it, you're in outer space in an astronaut suit, still whispering, bitch.
I said bitch. He goes to the place where there literally is no sound. so he can that's the only way he can get quiet enough to escape. Yeah, I mean it's in comedy, in sketch and improv, it's called heightening, right? You just you take one concept, you take a comedic engine, and you heighten it through the roof. You look like me, really. You look just like me, sir. You just, yeah, you. Are we related? That's cool. I got brothers all over the place. I don't know. I never know when one is waiting to say hi, meet me for the first time. I don't have any money for you, man. I'm sorry. No.
Was there a sketch that was too crazy that you know, even though your name is on the show, that you just were like, we're not shooting this, but it's still one of my favorites left on the drawing board?
You know, there's a couple of sketches that were in one that we ended up making in the last season was something that was, you know, I was pushing for years, and they just didn't get it. Comedy Central didn't get it. But it's called Gremlins 2. It was about...
Okay. It's genius.
You guys got it. I knew you guys were out there somewhere. I was like, trust me, the people who get it are gonna really get it. And so in the last season, I was like, what the fuck? We're making this shit. I don't care. This is it. And so that was a dream come true.
What about something you didn't get to make?
Something that I personally chose not to make. That was a sketch that I believed in. It was a sketch about 9/11, and it was a sketch that was in the. It was a documentary, like all these, you know, every year we see a 9/11 documentary with the survivors. And the whole idea was, over the years, we've seen these documentaries and we never see the testimonials that didn't quite make the documentary. How could that, you know, possibly be funny? We kept it very grounded, and we made sure the characters were very real, because the idea was that, you know, there's assholes everywhere. So yeah, there were some douchebags at 9/11 as well. And so, you know, the idea was, it was everybody, what, you know, you see one guy testimony. He's like, I was on the fifth floor when the plane hit the building, and people are talking to the press is talking to people who are on the first floor, and I just I think that my 9/11 experience was a little more real. So it was really appealing to this human nature, this element of human nature that tries to put us closer to this disaster and sort of own this disaster. It was a really interesting sketch. I ultimately, you know, Comedy Central wanted us to do it. You know, I wrote the sketch with a partner, Becky Drysdale, but for me, who's amazing. You know, for me, I ended up making the call because I felt like it was just the type of thing where I didn't want anybody who had a loved one there to see it. So it was just, that was kind of the killing factor. It wasn't ready. We didn't need to push that envelope then. I love the sketch. I think in a lot of ways it's important, but it wasn't ready.
Your first feature film experience was with Alex Rubens for Keanu, for your first produced film
for that's the first film I wrote. Yeah.
What was your biggest lesson as a screenwriter on that before we get to Get Out, because that was your first produced film in 2016?
You know, it was, first of all, it was a plan that was executed, and I think we knew that we would be in a place where a Key and Peele movie would be interesting to some people in a couple of years when we wrote it. And so, you know, it just shows that, you know, a certain amount of strategy can work, if it's right. You know, I love that movie. I think Peter Atencio did an amazing job. If I could do it all over again, I would spend a little bit more time on the script.
Interesting. What part? Or in what regard to the script?
You know, I would just give it more rewrites. I would go in for more detail, more character develop, more laughs, just in all over. Every time I look at a script and go through it, you know, you can you can find something new. You can find you can look at any rewrite with, and you know, sometimes when it, you know, and something that worked for me on this is like I do. First of all, like 400 passes of the thing, you know, I'm exaggerating, but it felt like 400 passes. And, you know, you sit down, you look at your script, you say, you know what, this time I'm going to go through it. I'm going to make sure every character has their own voice, that it's not all my voice through the character. Okay. You know what, this time I'm just going to go through, I'm going to make sure all the fucking scary parts are scary. So just kind of like take a precision project. And rewriting is fun when you sort of give yourself those little detailed assignments.
Is that indicative of something that you weren't always able to do on Key & Peele? Because on television, it moves a little fast. You have a faster production schedule, and you got a lot of shows to make.
Key & Peele, I feel like we did finish the sketches to a large extent. You know, I think Keanu was a little different. I love this movie, so I hate to take away from anybody who...
Of course, and all artists always would love to keep rewriting.
Is a fan. Yeah, well, right. And Keanu was one that it should have been as good a movie as Key & Peele was a sketch show. And so I think I'm the only one to blame for that. It was moving, and... We were making the movie maybe before I got to get fucking Kubrick on that script, you know, and go to town.
Well, I still laughed when I saw it, and luckily Key & Peele was recognized, 2 Emmys, and a Peabody Award and a WGA nomination for writing as well. So
yeah.
you have a great pass as a writer. Getting into tonight's movie,
yeah.
I'm curious how Get Out started for you. And I would be remiss, and by the way, you do not have to answer this, but mm-hmm. I'm curious about the influence of it. I'm not trying to get too personal, but I think it's impossible to get around it. Your father is African-American, and mm-hmm. your mother is Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
You're married to a Caucasian lady.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something that, in your own past, you were a bit nervous about kind of meeting the parents? Is that like a primal fear that you had growing up or as a teenager? Is it not?
So, I mean, I can't say this one is about my wife or my wife's family.
Of course, I would hope not.
Otherwise, I'd get... No, but I wrote this before I met Chelsea, so, I came to the table with this baggage. Yeah, you know, first of all, I think it is one of the lessons I took from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which is one of the influences here, is that
absolutely,
yeah, as you can see, one of the reasons that film I think was so effective in its discussion with race is because it started with a situation that was universal. Take the race out of it, everybody can relate to the fear of meeting your potential in-laws for the first time. So that was at some point I had a revelation that was also the way to get in to this film. But in general, yeah, I think of myself as I'm a proud African American man. I see the world with through an African American lens. This movie is very personal. It's about bringing representation to a genre where I think black people aren't represented, and it's about giving us all a collective sort of experience in seeing through the eyes of a minority, seeing through the eyes of someone who in this situation feels like he's the other, like he's the outsider. I think people who recognize that experience will recognize the feeling. I think people who don't have that experience or don't recognize it will have a little bit of I was going to say I like Tiger Woods, but I don't think I should say that anymore. I think a big part of what is what makes story as an art form one of the most important pieces of communication in the world is that with a movie, with a book, with something that has a protagonist, we can, that's one of the only ways we can see through someone else's eyes and see if the story is given the sort of emotional continuity and that reality. We're all on the same page when we watch this movie. We're all with Chris. And I think that that experience, you know, hopefully it defies really the awful awkwardness that is this racial conversation that is a difficult and really uncomfortable thing for a lot of people, and something that feels like often doesn't go anywhere.
When did you first bring the idea to Blumhouse? Because it's like a match made in heaven by only a guy who could see a horror movie in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner as a possibility, as an influence.
That's right. Blumhouse is a perfect partner for this, especially because they allow the filmmaker to take ownership and do their film. You know, they've got that price point and that opportunity that if it works out, it can go get its universal wide release. So when I first, the first person I brought the movie to was this guy named Sean McKittrick at QC Entertainment, which is formerly Darko Entertainment, you know, the company that did Donnie Darko back in 2001. I sat down for a general meeting with him, and I was, you know, I said, in all honesty, I said, look, here, this is a premise for a movie that will never get made, but, you know, it's going to sort of show off what a weird, fucked up individual I am. And I told him the premise, and he said, look, let's make it. Let's do it. And that was really the first time I was like, shit, it's possible. About a year later, Blumhouse kind of caught wind of it after I had already written the script.
Let's talk about your habit for a second as a writer. When you sit down to write...
Weed?
Well, you could talk about that as well. But so when you sit down to write, how important is outlining to your process? Is it something that you do right off the bat?
Yeah. I'm the kind of guy who wants to know the entire movie before I write it. Same with sketch. Thank you. Yeah. So the nugget for this idea and several others started maybe 8 years ago after Mad TV. And I was kind of like, oh shit, what do I do now? Okay. Well, let's write, for fun. Let's write movie. It doesn't matter if these are ever going to go anywhere. What's the most fun movie I can write for myself? What's the movie that doesn't exist that I want to see? And the whole idea was just let's become a better writer through this. That sort of gave birth to this idea. I outlined this and along with other ideas for about 5 years before I realized this one was the one that was complete. Are you guys all writers? And
a lot of writers.
A lot of writers.
Sure.
So, you know, I will just say this about writing is that follow the fun. Follow what is fun to write. And the second something becomes, second you're sick of the idea you're working on, which will happen, you know, sometimes almost immediately, move to the idea that is now fun. This isn't going anywhere. Go follow the fun. If this one's fucked up, move to the next fun one. I had 5 projects open at once before I realized, oh, you know what? This one is starting to make a whole different kind of sense. That's Get Out. Okay, let's focus on this. Now I get what it is. But don't accept writer's block.
As you get into your outline.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For real.
As you get into your outline, is it kind of like bullet point, or do you kind of write it like a treatment? What does your outline look like on the page?
It's very bullet points, very listy, right? I make a ton of lists, and it can be, again, it's follow the fun. So if I'm getting obsessed with this idea of a secret society, then I'm looking on YouTube, I'm looking up the Knights Templar, trying to figure out, you know, the Order of the Golden Dawn. Okay, who's this group then? Who would they be? You know, I do all the work to create this fake secret society and their history, so that, you know, even though nobody ever gets to hear it, there's little signs that the depth is there. It's all about lists. It's all about research. It's all about kind of making connections in things.
When you sit down to write, do you give yourself a daily page count, or do you go for a certain amount of hours?
No, that's because that's not. that wouldn't be following the fun, right? So for me, it's like, look, if I make it one page, then cool. And then every now and then I'll hit that groove where I'm like, oh, shit, 40 pages later, this has been a good, fun night. But the second you're fed up, the second you're bored, you're already doing something wrong. Move on. Find the fun.
How long did it take for the first draft of Get Out?
And then so after, you know, developing the idea for 5 years and then bring it to Sean McKittrick. He says, let's write it. I basically took about 2.5-3 months to write the first draft of the script.
That's great.
It felt like I was given permission to go make this thing. I was like, I know how to make this. This is what I've been working up to. So the fun just flew for me when I got in there. And it wasn't until halfway through writing the script I realized I was literally the only person who could direct this script. It was that personal, that much of a point of view film.
I want to get to that next, but just, you know, you touched on it a second ago. I've interviewed a lot of writers about what they do about writer's block. It seems like you don't get it. So is that just something you say you don't believe in?
Well, this was something I sort of reached after years and years of dealing with writer's block. And like I said, you know, 8 years ago, I found myself really feeling like I wanted to do this, but I lacked the skill to pull off my favorite movie. So the point of writing to me sort of shifted from, you know, Mad TV, getting something on the air, to something I could every time I go out, I get excited about going back home and like cracking. Okay, let's get, what's that secret society? Who are they? It was a revelation I had halfway into my writing career.
So basically, your advice for writer's block is to follow the fun per se, and if you get stuck, just put it down for a second and come back to it.
That's right.
Yeah, when
you move over to this next project that is fun for whatever reason. So I'm writing this over here, and then I go, you know what? Fuck this. There's this movie about a bunch of chupacabra that's really gnawing at me over here. This seems fun. Let's go figure out what the chupacabra. At some point in this project or this next one over here, you'll have a revelation or unlock something, and you'll be like, oh, that's fucking cool. And you know what? I can take that and put that in here. That kind of solves this problem. So sometimes it does feel like my brain is trying to work out this the stumbling block or the writer's block in this, and it knows to find fun in this other project, and you can kind of combine them and compare and say, you know what, Chupacabra film, you are no more. But
it's like a subconscious thing, it sounds like.
It's a yes, definitely. And that's part of following the fun, I think, is leading with the subconscious. I do believe in this, the idea of starting with images that you don't even quite know why they're important to you. Dreams, smoke a little weed and just listen to some music. And when you connect, when you're doing the work, it's connecting those images. It's trying to answer the question for yourself, why is that image powerful to me?
Interestingly, out of all the years on Key & Peele, you did not direct, and this is your directorial debut, to my knowledge. You did not direct an episode.
That's right.
So what was your biggest lesson that you learned as a director here? And we'll get to the spoiler section of the podcast in a second, but just as a director, what was your biggest trial by fire here for this movie? Because aside from your script being great, the direction was on point as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Directing, like I said, this is a total dream come true for me, and it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do, but I loved it. I think directing is basically, it's like you're running down a hallway and somebody's shooting a machine gun at you, and you have to fucking Neo all that shit, make it to the end of the hallway with your vision intact. So you know, the big takeaway is you have to be aggressively able to evolve. You have to be able to when you every day you're going to hit these obstacles. and you know, take a cue from, you know, how Steven Spielberg crafted Jaws, which is when he hit these obstacles, he took them, took the reality of these obstacles, he made them, he turned them into a choice that literally made the movie better. You know, of course, the you guys know the Spielberg thing where the shark would never fucking work, so he had to not show the shark for most of the movie, which ends up being the, you know, one of the great horror choices there is. So for me, I got to a point where the inevitable thing that goes wrong, I looked at as, that as a gift. If you the more correct choices you make while creating a film, the better. Well, and any obstacle is an opportunity to make a better choice or another good choice.
What was your Jaws moment? What was the thing that went wrong on Get Out that you had to recalibrate?
One thing was we were going to shoot here for up until about a month before we ended up shooting. I get a call from Jason Blum on my Christmas vacation. Says, "Sup, buddy?" Okay. All right, weird news. We didn't get the rebate. The rebate fell through in Los Angeles. We got a. You guys don't know I'm doing the best fucking Jason Blum right now. Rebate fell through, buddy. We got to shoot somewhere else. Which of course is an absolute nightmare for any director. I'd been in prep for probably about a month. I had. You know, people in place. Because of this, I lost several key creatives that were, you know, had already put in work. I chose Alabama for some fucked up masochistic reason. I don't know why.
Well, tax credits, I'm sure.
Well, yes, the tax credits. There was a, you know, there's a few places that have the tax credits, and Alabama to me was, you know. You know, you've got Atlanta, you got New Orleans, and they are just full of projects. That's where everybody goes. Alabama has a relatively young film infrastructure, so I was like, you know what? That's where we're gonna go. That's where I'm gonna. The only place where I'm gonna get crew that can do the job. And it's one of these things that. You know, that was a hard one to see the silver lining of, but...
How soon after that were you shooting?
I think probably about 5 weeks. We probably pushed it a week, probably.
Wow, that was 5 weeks before production.
Yeah. Well, it was probably like a month, but I think we pushed it a week or two or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wouldn't make sense for a tax credit to exist in Los Angeles because nothing is ever shot here.
Yeah, right?
I mean, California, why would we have a tax credit?
It is one of these weird, tricky things where... Yeah, the idea of getting a movie made in Los Angeles is almost is hard. It's hard to convince them to let you do that unless you sort of win the lottery, so to speak. We tried to shoot here for Keanu as well, but you know,
it's very strange. And the state government should do something about it to make it better. I want to get to the spoiler section. What was your budget and schedule as the last non-spoiler question?
Budget and schedule. So the budget was. I'm not going to be specific because I've
That's fine.
Been told not to be.
All good.
But it was a standard Blumhouse micro budget. The schedule was 23 days. We did some additional photography.
23. Wow, that's excellent.
Thank you. Yeah, that was. It was crazy. It was. I never want to do that again.
Well, so let's get into the spoilers now. If you're listening to the podcast and you haven't seen the movie, please press pause and come back once you do. You know, this concept of this fake liberal family who is part of a cabal who is dealing in modern brainwashing slavery would be the only way to define it. At what point did you realize that it was going to be that? Along with an auction with bingo cards, because it's creepy but kind of silly but entirely creepy at the same time. Great antagonist.
Yeah, thank you. I made this movie in the image of two of my favorites, Stepford Wives, Rosemary's Baby. You guys can see it, and I love those movies. First of all, because they're social. They're about gender. They're about they're about men making decisions for women's bodies and making choices behind their backs. And they're done in such an entertaining, fun, intriguing, fucked up way. So those movies were sort of a cue to me that something like this was possible. You could do that with race, and in the same way that I don't cry foul for all men when I leave those movies. I knew white people could come and see this movie and get it. Initially my desire was to write the movie that it looks like it's going to be, which is that they're hypnotizing black people, re-enslaving them, which, you know, that was the worst fear, or the sort of what was underneath, I think, my personal racial fears is that, you know, somehow we haven't moved on at all from slavery. You know, obviously you see Ava DuVernay's documentary, The 13th. She shows us why we have not.
Great documentary.
And it's amazing. And then there was just one, you know, every now and then you'll get a revelation about the movie. And that was probably a couple of years into conceiving this one. You know, I realized the sort of brain swap element, that was a more a sort of symbolic form of slavery, a more abominable, horror appropriate way of slavery, and that along with that came this revelation that, you know, the sort of the exotification and the desire for black people's bodies was not in fact a compliment in its core. That it is a side of the same beast of racism that we see with racial violence, even though it's a seemingly more pleasant form of it.
And it was interesting because you also have tropes of John Frankenheimer's seconds or being John Malkovich in there. One of the really interesting things was actually the character of Rose, in which it seemed like at a certain point there was still a chance that she might be a good person and didn't realize that her family was doing this. Yeah. At what point did you play with how to reveal that she's in on it, obviously? Because the pictures in the box was just a great great way to do it without dialogue.
Yeah.
So,
Thank you.
A lot of people get stuck in the dialogue and the explaining, but you did it silently. And I'm just curious if there ever was an iteration where she was an ally rather than a foe.
Nope, there wasn't that. There wasn't an, you know, like I said, I was, you know, I studied Rosemary's Baby and the Stepford Wives when I was first making this film. There was an iteration of it where we are meant to, you know, much like the husband characters in those movies, we as an audience are meant to know that she's in on it the whole time, because it works in those movies. And at some point I realized, wait a second. If you could pull some Kaiser Soze shit, why would you not pull some Kaiser Soze shit? So that at that point, it's like, okay, all right, we're going to take this up one notch. If I can do the impossible and I can hide the fact that this woman who is literally bringing him into harm's way, if I can hide the fact that she's in on it, then I'll have a really great revelation. Now, I know that it's the type of thing that crosses everyone's mind at some point. Some people certainly figure it out. It's hard not to go there, especially for, you know, movie fans like us. But, you know, I still wanted to build in enough doubt in our mind and really have make choices with Rose that would make you say, yeah, but they wouldn't have her they wouldn't have her like that if she was evil. Like, why she wouldn't be the one who is causing, you know, is more alarmed by race than he is. You know, she would be trying to pacify him and keep him in the zone. She's woke right now. and also, of course, just relying on the, you know, what felt sort of impossible about this movie in the first place. But, you know, I knew in my heart that anybody who's seeing a movie in a wide release in America would have to think there's no way Universal Studios would allow the one good white person in this film to also be evil. There's no way they would do that.
And it's so, great that they did.
And so that's so great that they did.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you also have this really personal element for Chris's trauma with his mother dying. It's a great monologue. It's the end to him being hypnotized rather than more hocus-pocus stuff. You let it be really personal. When did that idea to kind of ground things come by in your writing?
You know, it came probably around the middle, and there's several things that's about for me. First of all, giving the character a personal nightmare. I feel like the any good horror movie is a tailor-made nightmare, personal nightmare for the protagonist. And so Chris's personal demon was one of neglect. It's one where he felt like he did not, his mother was suffering, his family, his history was suffering, and he did nothing. He was petrified by fear. He was traumatized by fear, and marginalized by you know, the screen in front of him. Now, you know, just to get into like the fucking crazy, some of my favorite shit about this movie is that, you know, the sunken place itself to me is kind of a representation of the marginalization of African Americans in this country, in the in this genre. Black people, we are a loyal horror movie audience, and we go to watch these films where we're not really represented in. We're not, our skin isn't in it, and our sensibilities. Bitch, get out the fucking house. Do the right shit. Leave, motherfucker, leave. The shit that we address in this movie. And so we are in this sunken place, right? We are in this dark hole watching this fucking screen, and we can't, they won't do what we're telling them to do. So,
and that's why you called the movie Get Out.
So that's why I called the movie Get Out. It was meant to address this lack of representation, not only of our skin, but also our perception. And you know, this goes for all, you know, horror movie fans. I think we all are, you know, we're a little bit more keyed in to what's going on. But you know, I think there's something about the African American experience, the experience of being a minority, that has many frustrations, but it also does endow us with a certain ability to perceive some bullshit that's going on that maybe other people don't have all the time. So I think it's important in this that, you know, Chris and Rod's blackness is what helps them get out of this situation. You know what I mean?
Like a spider sense?
It's a, ooh, that TSA shit's tingling. Yeah, it's like a spidey sense.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. All of our issues have been converted, and we're now trying to make the technology active so you could read it on the web, and I can't wait for you to see the web rendition quite soon. I think we're also going to be available for Android tablets for the first time, so more on that when I find out. But right now, issue 26, our Oscar issue, is our current issue, and if you have an iPad, you could check it out, and I hope you will. We did this really cool thing that we've been doing for a few years. It's in our Oscar Lessons section, where we have this year's Oscar-nominated screenwriters tell us about their favorite scene, their toughest scene, a deleted scene they missed, and also what it took to craft their memorable openings and endings for their screenplays. And not only do they tell us this, we publish the scenes they're talking about right there as well. And you also have the entire script to read if you'd like to, too. This year's Oscar Lessons participants include the writers of Arrival, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. We also interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda about creating his Oscar-nominated song for Moana, and Justin Hurwitz about his 3 Oscar nominations for the music of La La Land. Plus, Oscar-nominated cinematographer Linus Sandgren on shooting La La Land, along with Roger Ross Williams for his Oscar-nominated documentary, Life Animated. You could also read the full Blacklist screenplay Burn Run, along with an interview by its writer, Matt Tente, and read about what it took to create the popular graphic novel, Mayday. There's also full Sundance coverage, plus TV articles that include Zal Batman-Lige and Britt Marling on creating Netflix's The OA. Scribe Steve Melching and Henry Gilroy chat about writing on Star Wars Rebels. Gary Whitta tells us about his experience on Rogue One. And last but not least, co-writer-director James Mangold fills us in on what it took to close Wolverine's cinematic storyline with Logan. Plus, there's plenty of other pieces to explore as well, so don't miss this fantastic packed issue. And I can't wait to hear your feedback on it. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and Issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar, so treat yourself. And hey, while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll also visit this episode's sponsor, ScreenCraft.org, to see all the great contests they're currently hosting and the ones that they have coming up as well. And remember, if you use discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, you could save 10% off your screenplay contest entry. So look, I gotta say again, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project, Backstory. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right back onto the stage to continue hearing what Jordan Peele has to say about his passion project, Get Out.
Well, so, you know, it's interesting because your script is so tight that, you know, aside from him having that personal story of not helping out his mother, again, it echoes later when it's why he can't leave Georgina behind, because he doesn't understand that it's really the grandma trapped in there,
right,
and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's a very... Please.
I knew that that was one of the moments that where, you know, I'm generalizing a lot, but black people would watch that, but... Don't go back, motherfucker. So I knew I had to build in a reason that we could go, oh, his mom, he's going to go because of his mom. He's going to go for, okay, that's family. I understand it. you just want to address it. And also to have him just say, he's got the voice that's saying what we're saying in there, that would be satisfying. And so it's so fun to watch you guys watch this movie and like hear you going through it, you know, hear you experiencing exactly how it was intended. It's magic.
You know, you brought it up a second ago. His friend Rod, you know, obviously people know you as a comedian, but you made a very serious movie, you know, and it was great when Rod had his comedic moments. Tell us what kind of inspired the character and how much comedy to infuse this movie with, because you did great for action and horror, but we would have been kind of disappointed if there was no comedy.
Well, you know, I think you would have. It was very clear at a certain point that the sort of the stress, the tension that I was asking an audience to sit through here was intense. It was like, you know, one of the movies I looked at was Funny Games, you know, this real fucked up downer of a film, but it has
not so funny.
Not so funny, but it has a very special and unique build of tension where you as an audience member and the characters know what's that something bad is coming, but there's no way to stop it once it's in motion. It's pretty crazy. And but for me, I knew that when we have that kind of attention going on and I'm putting the audience through that kind of stress, they are primed to experience the joy of the release. So the key with Rod to me was that he wouldn't come in and tell jokes. He wouldn't sell out the reality of the story. The reason Rod is fun and funny is because he's actually grounding the movie more. He brings this movie to a place where reality exists. He's saying what we wish somebody would say in a horror movie, including get out, leave, motherfucker, leave. I think the key of why Rod is such a relief, you know, besides the fact that he has an amazing performance and has some funny lines, but he grounds it in reality more than it is.
Right. You were painting in broad strokes because it was, you know, it was another left turn when he goes to the police and they just simply make fun of him because, you know, we think, oh, the police are going to come help, and no one does.
It's reality.
True. No. Your broadest stroke was that beautiful third act entry point in which, you know, he's just brought down to the basement. Like, you know, like that's the beginning of the third act in which there are no car keys to save him.
Yeah.
I'm curious in editing what your lessons were learned, because that's the final stage of storytelling. Were there any deleted scenes you want to talk about? Any scenes that moved around in different places than you wrote them? Tell us about your editing process.
It was editing was fun. It was fun. Like, you know, the stakes were sort of off to an extent, and you get to be a fan of the work everyone's done for the first time, and nothing is more satisfying than just cutting something that sucks and being left with everything that you like. There was a couple things. You know, you saw in one of the trailers, there's like a monster, like a deer monster. That was in the original. You know, I didn't want it in the trailer because it was not in the movie. But you know, they wanted it because they wanted to help show a little bit of a little bit more intrigue, and that this was more of a traditional horror film. But I originally had this puppet of this deer demon creature that was representing Chris's darkest fears in the sunken place with him, you know, so just to like one notch more nightmarish, make that there's something in there with him. That wasn't necessary.
Well, that's interesting because they hit a deer in the beginning of the movie, and
yeah,
then when they're watching the Coagula video by Richard Armitage, the deer is above the television as well. So you're definitely percolating that in there.
It was definitely a motif that you know, has several significance. You know, one is simply just the idea of being a city boy going up to the country where deer are vermin, and you know, that's a sort of disorienting thing. It's like, oh shit, I'm from the city. These motherfuckers out here don't care about life. What the? This is some crazy shit. They want to shoot deer out here. I'm like, I have a hard time killing a water bug in the city. But then also, you know, obviously a metaphor for fire alarm? No.
A metaphor for something.
This is the worst sound ever.
The fact those lights aren't flashing, I think, means okay.
I think we're okay, but why would they try to annoy us during a fire? I don't understand what the purpose of that is. All right.
I think that was a hello from the Armitage family.
That was okay. Yes. Creepy. So yeah, no, but the deer ultimately, yeah. You probably see, is a metaphor for his mother as well, right? This
left to die.
Left to die on the side of the road.
The most fascinating thing that was running through my mind when I saw this at the library at Sundance as the surprise screening, and everybody was losing their mind. You wrote this under Obama, and this is being released.
He was right above me
in the Trump.
looking down, it was weird.
This is being released in the Trump era. Do you feel like meaning has changed and grown, in my opinion, greater import in these days for a film like this?
Yeah. So originally this film was meant to address this post-racial lie. So we had Obama as president. Race and racism was something that was almost, it felt like we weren't supposed to talk about it anymore. Like, people were like, no, don't even talk about it. You're making it alive. Like, it's fucking, you know, Tinkerbell and I'm clapping or some shit. People didn't want to talk about race. It was uncomfortable, and people wanted to pretend it didn't exist. And that was what the movie was about. Now, there's no mistake that race is here. It's a problem. It's a conversation that there is a white nationalist somewhere pulling the fire alarm. They want us out. Oh God. Yeah.
The timing on that was beautiful.
Now, that race is part of the discussion in a way that it wasn't when I started, I think that this movie will actually have more people willing to receive it, because it's no longer a discussion people don't want to have. It's one that we know we have to have, and this may be the most fun way to interact with that conversation. And so I think if you lead with entertainment, you lead with joy, fear, these visceral emotions, and give people a communal experience that, hey, maybe not all the conversation about the movie will be good, but it will be taking place. And conversation is an art and story, like I say, I think is the only weapon we have against the true horrors of the world. And you know, the real horror, I think, behind this film, that what this is about is the disproportionate incarceration of Black people.
Something that we hope is decreased, but the Trump administration is probably not putting it on the forefront.
I got a feeling it's not like one on the agenda.
But the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU are continuing to work on it, so we take solace in that. Tell me your toughest scene as a writer, the scene that you kept coming back to again and again, and how did you creatively crack the challenge?
You know what was tough was the scene where Stephen Root is explaining the whole thing. This was something I knew I wanted to do, which was just at a certain point in this movie, just give the audience everything that they want.
Through the television.
You know, have this like, you know, like when Morpheus has his whole, here's the Matrix, and bitch, I explained the Matrix. You're like, oh shit, he just said it. I wanted that. There's also a movie called Martyrs. Has any fucked up people seen that movie? You can see the connections. There's a moment towards the end of the movie where, and I won't give anything away, but somebody explains what's going on, and it is just chilling because it's so plain, it's stated with such confidence that you sort of know there's no talking this person out of what's going on.
Sure, just like in Wicker Man, there's a moment like that as well when it's
like in Wicker Man,
the original, not the Nick Cage version.
Like the original Wicker Man. There's that moment. I think
So that was tough for you on the page to get that exposition down?
Yeah, it was hard for it not to feel like I had just given up on all subtleties. I think part of what helped me with that one was sort of developing the character of Jim Hudson a little bit to make him be the guy who was the most quote unquote colorblind, the most the guy who really feels like, you know, first of all, he's blind, but second of all, he really feels like, look, I know you think race is what this is about. It is with them. It's not with me. It's not with me. And that even if he was telling the truth, there was there was still this dehumanization of the character. There was still this valuing of his own presence over this other character. I also sort of secretly believe that he feels that a Black artist would get more attention than a white artist in this time.
Could there be a sequel?
There could.
All right. Good to know.
There absolutely could.
That's good news. We are almost out of time. I could take one or two questions from the crowd. I saw a hand all the way in the back of the room right there. You, sir. His question was, in horror or comedy, how far do you know how to dial it down before you lose your message when you have something that you want to say or get across?
Why dial it down?
Or dial it up.
How do you find the tonal, the tone of how extreme to go? I think the answer is, I think you know the answer. It's the movie you want to watch. It's the movie you wish got made. It's the movie they may never make, but God damn it, if they did make it, it would be your fucking favorite movie. I say go for it. People want something different and fresh, and they also want a familiarity. They also want a way to relate to the movie and a box to put the movie in. So for me, the box was clear. It was that Ira Levin style of thriller. Your own personal limit and taste is the only thing you need to honor.
Another question. Interesting question. As a writer and director, how much did you lean on your editor as a collaborator?
We definitely worked in really intense collaboration. I'm the only person who knows how to tell the story. So I give them all the opportunities to pitch and to give me opinions, but you're the only one that really knows the story. That being said, I can't get enough of anybody's opinion on the movie. My editor, my DP, my actors, craft services, the person on the street that I say, hey, you want to read a script? Even if someone gives you feedback that's not right, it's coming from somewhere that is true. So often, when I get a note from somebody who doesn't get what I'm doing, who doesn't like it, I try to figure out how to keep my vision but still make it so no one else will give that note.
The writing and directing in this movie was sublime. I love that you chose horror as a genre and cannot wait to see what you do next. Give it up again to writer-director Jordan Peele.
Thank you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to this episode's sponsor, ScreenCraft.org. And remember, next time you're on their site ready to enter your script into one of their fantastic contests, don't forget to use discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word. It'll save you 10% off your entry fee. Of course, many thanks again to writer-director Jordan Peele for being so generous with his time and coming down to chat about his excellent feature film debut, Get Out. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I want to thank you again for spreading the word about issue 26 of Backstory on the iPad, our Oscar issue. And also thanks for letting folks know that Backstory.net will become the fully functional magazine this year, and it will also be available on Android devices as well. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.